content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Aniko Gal from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Vogue Magazine and Teen Vogue. Well, we're back today. It is, what day is it? It's the 25th of April, and we're well into spring, and we have a lot of wonderful magazines for you. The first one is entitled Gray Matters, and this is not about your brain. It's about your hair. As a new generation leans into hair's natural aging process, Lauren Metchling considers breaking up with her colorist. And this is from Vogue magazine. One evening last summer, I was seated at the Brooklyn Hair Salon, where I spend so much of my waking life. As my scalp was being slathered in a color formula best described as deep espresso, with tones of roasted hazelnut, I watched a local jewelry designer settle into the station across from mine. "The regular touch-up?" her colorist asked. "Actually," she replied tentatively, "I'm ready to grow in my grays." I cast my eyes away from the mirror, embarrassed to be privy to so intimate an exchange. A few months later, I scrolled past an image of Jocelyn Bodone on designer Rachel Comey's feed, and started to rethink my every 5 weeks habit. The 60-year-old prop stylist and interior decorator, who had recently walked Comey's spring show, brandished silver weed curls that looked radically fresh. I spotted another gorgeous riff on the mother-of-pearl shade on the baby-faced assistant at my dermatologist's office. "I've already tried all the other colors out there," she told me with a shrug when I paid her a compliment on her new smoky tone. After years of being a telltale sign of getting old, a stigma so toxic for women in America that almost no one, no matter her age, will admit she is old, Mary Pfeiffer recently wrote in her widely shared New York Times essay, "The Joy of Being a Woman in Her 70s, "It's suddenly hip to be gray. You can see it on the pop charts as musicians such as Cardi B, Ariana Grande, and 17-year-old pop phenom Billie Eilish have all had to go at lunar hues that channel cyberpunk princesses, and on the runways where women of a certain age, Stella Tennant, Erin O'Connor, Pat Tracy, are embracing their salt and pepper strands to the clamor of casting directors. "Brands are asking for models with their natural hair colors and textures," confirms Travis Weaver, who is in charge of the lineups at shows such as Comey's. "The frosty streaks communicate authenticity," suggests New York style gallerist Bridget Donahue, 38, who frequently sweeps her own into an updo to display the flashes of white that run underneath. "Look no further than the drugstore aisle for evidence. Earlier this year, L'Oreal named silver the hair color of the year." Concealing grays has been a popular practice since the early 20th century, following the advent of the first synthetic hair dye. And while wearing them with pride entertained a brief comeback in the 1970s, when feminists eschewed hair color in what Lois Banner, a professor of history and gender studies at the University of Southern California, calls, quote, "a backlash against the patriarchy," end quote, that flirtation quickly fizzled. But today's pale craze may have staying power, a natural outgrowth of the body, of the body positive movement. It goes hand in hand with a wide reconsideration of long and gray beauty norms. "Now," says Banner, "choosing to wear your hair gray is an opportunity to assert independence and style. It's my favorite thing about myself, says Sophia Rowe, a social media star chef and wellness advocate who was 16 when she started seeing silver. Now 30, she is the proud owner of copious tinsel-like ringlets that punctuate her otherwise onyx curls. It's like I got bopped in the head with a magical stick. That's not to say breaking with the bottle is easy. It can be just as much work as maintaining your roots, explains Christophe Robin, the cult French colorist who regularly mixes mahoganies and flaxens for Kylie Minogue and Tilda Swinton. There are a slew of washout color products such as Bumble and Bumble's Velvety BB Color Sticks and R Plus Co's Art School Root Touch-Up Gel to help blend natural grays as they come in. A better bet than adding artificial silver additions, according to Robin, who prefers to skip anything requiring a preliminary bleaching process that can be damaging to the hair. Instead, he prescribes an acidic pH shampoo, such as his own wheat germ formula, used in tandem with Santa Maria Novella's Violet Vinegar Rinse, to lock in the cuticle and protect against environmental pollutants that can turn a perfect pewter into a dull yellow. In my native habitat of brownstone Brooklyn, women of a creative ilk cultivate streaks of white and silver as part of a uniform that includes a detaché knitwear and shearling-lined clogs. It's a constant endorsement of revisiting my natural hair color, whatever it may be. Perhaps I'll discover that it's that of a Norse goddess or the morning fog over Mexico City. But images of ashy pigeons and tarnished silverware inevitably swoop in, and I lose my courage. And maybe that's fine, too. I recently ran into the jewelry designer whose color evolution I'd been following for the past year. Her brush with grayness had reached its conclusion, and she'd returned to a warm, rich chestnut. Going silver and back again. What's more empowering than that? And here is a note by a designer. All right, design, Trey Chic, and it's T-R-A-Y. Since 2012, Utopia Goods founders Bruce Slorak and Sophie Tatlow, partners in work and life, have designed textiles starring flora and fauna as Australian as the upward inflection. Wattles and kookaburra birds make appearances in the label's William Morris-like patterns, though Morris and his arts and crafts aesthetic were both born in England. The craze for the movement was most fervent down under, and it seems the fever has yet to break. When Utopia Goods splashed their favorite textile patterns onto cocktail trays, Tatlow explains, they all but sold out. Crafted from reforested plywood and water-based ink, the brand celebrates nature in more ways than one, the trays are back for a second round of production. How did they choose which textiles transferred over? The bolder the better, says Tatlow. The trays are small. They can afford to be loud. Well, speaking about natural things and art, here's an article from Vogue.com. Environmental art, a mood board of what inspired and what sold at the conservatory reveals that it's all about the experience of being there first, buying later. Fashion. As you approach the foyer of the conservatory, the brand new store in the center of the emerging Manhattan neighborhood known as Hudson Yards, you have the sensation of time traveling to a world that's part 19th century botanical garden atrium, part mid-century hotel lobby. Where you're really headed, though, is to the future of retail, which is fast becoming as centered on community as it is on commerce. I think about it every minute, says Brian Bulk, the Conservatory's mastermind, and what he thinks about is changing our understanding of what shopping is. Before taking on Hudson Yards, Bulk spent a few decades in retail in Texas as the founder of 4510 and, before that, a Dallas flower store. At the Conservatory, a palpable environment of green plants and flowers designed by New York's reigning floral impresario, Lewis Miller, greets visitors and replaces the usual store windows. People are not going to expect it, Bulk said, touring the space recently. Though there are plenty of familiar stores elsewhere in Hudson Yards, the city's first Neiman Marcus, a new 4510, Stuart Weitzman, and a two-story H&M, all connected to the High Line and the new Equinox Hotel, when you pass through the Conservatory's entrance, you'll enter a space that you might first confuse for a branch of the Staley Wise Gallery, which has curated a selection of Ron Galella photos from the 70s and 80s for the space. You'll see crystal jewelry by Irene Neuwirth and ocean-inspired Deju jewelry by Sarah Beltran. There's also a meditation space operated by Bastide. The centerpiece, though, will be a restaurant where customers sit in Eames chairs surrounded by Knoll wall coverings and Pacific Northwest plantings. With culinary accessories from Finesse, Thomas Keller's line, some of the food is by Keller as well. All of it, of course, from items to experience to the food, is for sale. As for the fashion, forget racks, forget stacks. Designer pieces from regenerated Stella McCartney cashmere to Jill Sander shirting have been edited and commingled. Yes. But here's the catch. You can't actually buy anything at the Conservatory in the traditional sense. Instead, an advisor will, after answering any questions about sizing or really anything else, register you on the Conservatory's website. Once you're on the site, the magic of coding connects your shopping cart directly to the brands whose pieces you have just seen, touched, and tried on. Once purchased, the pieces are sent to you at home or, if you prefer, to the Conservatory for later pickup, sans the scourge of cardboard boxes. You cannot, however, simply buy the site without visiting the store first, or buy from the site. What this represents is a sea change, a true tipping point for retail. Without racks of inventory to manage, Bulk is free to focus on the sort of immersive experience that seems to ask you what you want instead of telling you, to lead you instead of push you. He takes his cues from the past, working to create the feeling of intimate luxury in the old Takashimaya on Fifth Avenue, or the casual, almost familial sense of the early days of Barney's New York. It's an admittedly shifting vista. Every 3 months, the Conservatory space will be redesigned, reconfigured, reimagined. Bulk's aha moment in all of this? Service went away, he says, and while wherever you shop may feel very zen and chic, if you have an informed and actually friendly person who greets you, that's what's going to make you want to go. Interesting. All right, and along the same lines, counting the numbers. 4510 is a 19-year-old Dallas boutique that sells the likes of Christopher Kane, Ekkehus Lotta, and Proenza Schuler, and Kristen Cole, its president and chief creative officer, is its breath of fresh air. Cole, the founder of LA's 10 over 6, has ambitiously set out to expand 4510's footprint. In addition to branches in Aspen and Napa, a Miami location focusing on emerging designers opened shortly after she took the reins a year ago. This month, she christens its new space at Manhattan's Hudson Yards, featuring all of 4510's retail arms, including women's, men's, emerging designers, and curated vintage. At a Chinatown restaurant called Juku, Cole snacks on a shisho leaf, a sole old Celine earring glinting in her left lobe beneath a casual bun of blonde hair. It seems apparent that the secret to her success, particularly in an age where brick-and-mortar shopping has been facing a kind of existential challenge, is confidently eccentric. Sarah Andelman had this quality too, with her now-shuttered Parisian boutique Colette. As in Dallas, much of the draw of the new 4510 promises to be through art and architecture. "We try to present fashion in the context of art," Cole says. The house collection includes works from such names as Tracy Emin, Jose Davila, Catherine Opier, Jürgen Teller, and Catherine Bernhardt, all of whose pieces will be displayed on rotation in New York. The store's facades at Hudson Yards, meanwhile, were done by the firm Snarkitecture. That's Snarkitecture's Ben Porto, with artist Caitlin Keog and designer Katie Stout flanking Cole in a green top above. So, yeah, she's up here pictured. What else sets 4510 apart? For one thing, variety. There's an energy and an exuberance to the Emporium's edit and layout. Be on the lookout for exclusive pieces as well, from Batshiva dresses to Rosie Ocelin pantsuits. After all, Cole says, shopping in a store is escapist. It's a moment to leave the real world for a few minutes. If we can carry that and amplify it, well, that's what makes this exciting. Okay, well, we're going to head over to teenvogue.com, and keeping with our theme of fashion, it seems, this morning, here's one other story that might interest you. Here's why clothing sizes are inconsistent. On June 5, H&M announced in a press release that they will be altering their sizing in the UK market. This change comes after several customers complained about how the brand's sizes are often vastly different from other stores. In March, one customer took to share a story of trying on a pair of jeans that she thought were her size, only to find out that she could barely get them over her legs. "I am very proud of my body," she wrote in the post. "It has taken a long time, but I am thoroughly content with my large hips, squishy thighs, and little tum. Thank you very much. I've always been a 12-14 and pleased with it, but when I tried on your jeans, I was annoyed, hot, and frustrated. The pair of jeans clearly were not made for a woman who is a size 14. She then went to ask the question, "Why is it okay for a brand to label an item of clothing as a size which it clearly is not?" Now H&M is looking to resolve the issue by moving the scale up one size. "Following customer feedback, we are taking the steps to change our women's wear measurements to be in line with UK sizing," H&M said in a statement. They went on to explain how the shift will work, stating, for example, the previous measurements and fit of a size 12 will now be the measurements of a size 10. A spokesperson for brand further explained to Teen Vogue, saying, "H&M in the USA will be updating their sizing structure for ladies' customers starting with new summer and fall 2018 products. We always want to listen to our customers and their feedback. The new sizing will be more in line with the North American sizing standard and the retail landscape of the market. While this change in direction is an exciting shift for many of the brand's customers, it does raise the question as to why these sizing discrepancies happen in the first place. Timo Rissanen, assistant professor of fashion design and sustainability at Parsons School of Design in New York City, told Teen Vogue that the reason might have something to do with the fact that size charts are subjective and every company chooses their own. Every company is free to adopt a system of their choosing, although most large retailers like H&M aim to work with widely used sizing systems, like those in the EU and the US, he said. According to Rissanen, this lack of accurate sizing is because the only body shape that is taken into account is that of a thin and straight size. Most sizing charts don't account for variation in body shape, he tells us. Most sizing charts for women assume an hourglass figure, and many women are not that shape. The other issue is regional variance. Not only is there regional variation in bodies, but there is variation in that variation. Average body types can vary from location to location, so creating one chart based off of a very small group of bodies doesn't make sense for anyone. So how could these issues be fixed? I don't think there is one fix, but each company would benefit from getting to know their customers better in terms of shapes and sizes. In the case of H&M, they would benefit from investing in regional analysis of body shapes and sizes. In other words, everyone is looking for that pair of jeans or a dress that fits them perfectly, so it can be really frustrating when you just can't find your size. As H&M has started to do, it's time for brands to start listening to their customers, reconsider what their sizes are based off in the first place, and adjust. Okay, and this one again is from Vogue.com. Staying power. With a monumental sculpture for New York's High Line and a show at Guggenheim, sculptor Simone Lee is having a statement-making season. I think one of the reasons I've had a successful career is because I dug my heels in when people told me I was making the wrong work, says the sculptor Simone Lee, before ticking off the list of criticisms. Her art was figurative when that style was romantic and naive. Her medium was clay when craftsmanship was passé. Her work was about race when black artists were supposed to be post-racial. She insisted on addressing it to an audience that is, like her, black and female. I feel we are moving on from this notion that your gender and race need to be left at the door if you're going to join Mount Olympus, Lee observes, smiling. I hung in there long enough for the art world to change. For the past several years, the artist, 51, has been reaping the rewards. In 2018, alone, she unveiled a solo show at Manhattan's Luring Augustine Gallery, won the Hugo Boss Prize, which means an exhibition at the Guggenheim this month, and beat out 11 shortlisted artists to install the inaugural sculpture on the High Line plinth, the new section of Manhattan's elevated park above West 30th Street. Next month, her work will also be featured at the Whitney Biennial. The plinth work is her largest yet, a monumental 16-foot bronze bust called Brick House. High Line director and chief curator Cecilia Alemani compares the figure to a contemporary goddess who, for the next 18 months, will stand on her lofty perch, gazing down over cars zooming up 10th Avenue. Or rather, not gazing. Lee's figure has a nose, mouth, and braids. It was important that she read as black. But her eyes are curiously absent. I'm not interested in representing any particular person, says the artist, and there's a specificity that comes with eyes. Instead, her piece evokes an amalgam of references. There's Mammy's Cupboard, a Mississippi roadside restaurant constructed in the shape of Aunt Jemima-like figure. There are Mosgoum houses, beehive-shaped earthen structures from Cameroon. Lee is interested in the inspiration modernist architects took from so-called primitive African huts. Brick house is slang for a kind of voluptuous, powerful femininity, little seen in Western sculpture, and raises a question. Both brick houses and mud huts are constructed by hand. So why do we exalt one and look down on the other? Lee never got an MFA. Her background is in philosophy and cultural studies, and she once called herself a reluctant artist. As a young mother living in New York, she would wake up early each morning to make things. I always had one more piece I wanted to do. I realized it was a habit that wasn't going to go away. When we connect on Skype, she waves hello with a jade roller she's been using to massage her face. I'm trying to put a little self-care into every moment, she admits, a Zen interlude within an unusually busy year. It's shocking to be 51 years old, having this career now, she marvels. This is usually when women artists disappear. Well, we have come to the end of our program today. You know, we've read so much, so many articles now about women artists and designers and so forth, and it just doesn't seem to matter what color or what height or look or weight or any of that anyone has. I think what really matters is that you go for what you believe in and don't let anyone stop you. I know you've heard this message, but what I would, recommend or ask you to do, we've talked about that journal very often that, you know, write this and that in. Write something in that you really strongly believe in, that, man, this is what I love. This is what I'm really passionate about. This is what I want to do. And see what you can do towards that, whether it's art or writing or politics or science or anything, climate change, who knows. Anyway, go for it. Write it down in your journal. So we have reached the end of today's program of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Annika Gall, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleradioreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919 832